I had a doctor's appointment yesterday, and I have more tests coming up than you would think. I'm on my deathbed.
I feel like you kind of are, though, so we need these tests.
My stomach has been killing me, like absolutely killing me, like debilitating. So I'm like, let's go figure it out. And they're like, maybe it's Lyme. Apparently Lyme disease is so prevalent this year, especially in PA. Like, he's like, I've diagnosed more Lyme disease patients this year than ever. So he's like, that could explain a lot of the symptoms. And
I didn't know stomach pain was like a symptom of Lyme's.
It's not, but it's like, I have other stuff that just always goes on that it could be. Some of the things I'm experiencing could be Lyme, and then the other stuff's good. So it's like, good Lord. But I made sure to like lotion my feet and my body with this Bath and Body. It's like leather and mahogany. Like, and it's a male doctor, so I'm not sure who I'm trying to impress, but I feel like I just want to go in there smelling half decent. Like, is that the right protocol? Like, I feel that's just respectful to smell good.
Oh, 100%. Especially because they got to be all up in your business. Yeah, you got to be smelling good.
He didn't make any comments, though, which I was a little disappointed. Like, you smell good, but I'm not sure I wanted him to at the same time.
That would make it weird. It's not weird that you wore the lotion and wanted to smell good, but it would be weird if he acknowledged it. A nurse could be like, oh, you smell good, but I feel like it's weird for one dude to tell another dude.
Yeah, so I don't know if I want to say something to him about just kind of being a little offended.
Don't you dare.
Listening to Murder Unscripted.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome back to Murder Unscripted, episode number 61 of the most immersive true crime podcast on the internet today. I'm your host, longtime true crime producer Ed Hydock, along with my bestie, the mouth of the South, but in the Northeast, Melissa Spivey. Melissa Spivey, not just any Melissa. Melissa Spivey.
Just some girl named Melissa.
Oh, man, Melissa. Well, we're in week 4 of our girl power block. These 5-week months screw me up, the ones that have 5 Tuesdays, because I always forget kind of where we're at. I feel like we should be done, but it's like, wait a minute, there's another Tuesday. So this is indeed week 4 of girl power, and we have covered some pretty badass women. Not only in our regular episodes, but also in our MU minis, which come out every Friday. And I absolutely love that we're doing these as a way to supplement our core show, because something shorter, something quicker still ties into everything. But it really gives us the time to cover some additional stories without doing a full deep dive.
Yeah. And for anyone who doesn't know what Ed's talking about, every Friday we release an MU mini, which is like 5 to 10 minute episodes. And we try to highlight a case or a victim where there isn't always enough information to do a full episode, but like their story is just as important as anybody's. And we always stick to our themes. So far this month, I talked about this amazing Italian woman, Paola Magni, who is a world-renowned forensic entomologist. She studies insects and similar creatures found at crime scenes. And I covered her work on the tragic case of 16-year-old Federica Mangiapello, who was murdered by her boyfriend. Like, the case itself was awful, but Paola is incredible.
Totally. And then last week, I covered everyone's favorite badass prosecutor, Kelly Sigler, who is not only a humongous justice warrior, humongous in the sense that she's not a large woman, she's humongous in the incredible work that she does, but she's also the star of Cold Justice, which is like a hybrid crime show that not only covers cases and profiles them, but also actively works to solve them. Super cool.
Yeah, I've seen a few episodes of that show, but I've also read true crime books where like she's been the prosecutor, and I think she would be the last person I would want to be cross-examined by.
She like goes for the throat. Well, this week we are back to discuss part 2 of the amazing survival story of 3 young women and eventually a child who survived more than a decade of torture, abuse, and straight-up psychological warfare at the hands of the monster Ariel Castro. And for anyone who missed last week, be sure to go back and check out part 1, obviously, because you will have a lot of questions if you don't this week.
Yeah.
But in part 1, we talked about Michelle Knight, who was a young woman who had already endured substantial abuse growing up, such a tumultuous childhood. And then she was essentially Castro's first victim.
I don't know that I believe that. Like, the first victim that we know of.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that Michelle was his first. I mean, we know that he would violently abuse his common-law wife before her death, Grimelda Figueroa, who she eventually died of this brain tumor that he essentially caused. But how do you go from being a just kind of a domestic abuser to someone who holds three people captive in a house? It seems like such a leap to me.
I think that he realized his bad behavior and he realized Grimelda left. And now he's like, well, I still want to continue that bad behavior, but I don't want anyone to leave me again.
That seems so extreme to me, but what do I know?
Well, let's just not do it.
Yeah. How about we just not do it? Well, before we get into today's case, I do want to extend the same blanket trigger warning that we did last week, because unfortunately we still have three people in captivity when this story begins and bad things happen to them. So if you're not okay hearing about sexual abuse, emotional abuse, torture, and this week we can add animal cruelty to the list, then I do suggest you skip this episode and just read a few articles if you're interested in learning more about the case.
Can I go? Do I qualify?
No, you are not allowed to leave. You can't leave me here. Well, let's dig in. So we mentioned last week that Michelle Knight was Ariel Castro's first victim. For roughly a year, she lived in that house. And she went through some unimaginable pain and torture. And as a reminder, during this time, he would starve her. He would beat her. He would sexually assault her. And it would be 8 long months before he permitted her to even take a shower. And occasionally, Castro would kind of back off for a little bit and show some semblance of humanity. Like, he would give her a paper and pencil to draw with, and this was her lifeline. She would write notes to Joey, who was, as a reminder, her child, that she was like, that's what got her in this in the first place, but that's also was her driving force. She wanted to get out of this to see her son, Joey. But she would draw pictures for him. She would write like a diary, almost, keeping track of things. And at one point, he even brought Michelle like a black and white TV. But I should mention that in addition to Castro being the worst thing, we'll call him a thing that you could ever imagine, he was also a humongous racist. So, and I bring this up because just the TV reminded me. So according to several sources, he hated black people. And that TV that he brought Michelle, if she got caught watching Fresh Prince of Bel-Air or any other show that had black actors in it, he would take it out on her in his usual violent fashion.
He is a disgusting monster. I have no words for him, but I will say, you were talking about them having the pen and pencils. He would, or pencils and paper, Michelle would hang her drawings up and he would rip them down and she would just put them right back up. Like, I'm going to keep putting them up.
Yeah, because like, what are you going to do to me? You know, at this point that you haven't already done.
Exactly.
Well, the mind games definitely did not end there. And this is something that we left out last week because it was already so heavy. And before I tell you this story, I want to reiterate the animal cruelty warning, because this is not something we really enjoy talking about, especially Melissa and I are such dog lovers. This is not a pleasant story, but I want you to understand who this guy was and the things that he would do to people. So do you remember that from week one, one of the tactics that Castro initially used to lure Michelle into that car was a promise that he had some puppies at home and that one of these puppies could maybe go to Joey what a great reunion, you know? Well, sometime during her captivity, he did actually get her a puppy. And it's like, wait, does this guy actually have a sliver of heart somewhere in that stupid chest of his? But then just as quickly, in that brief moment of kindness came on, it would essentially be ripped out from underneath her, because he would transform into his usual state of being an absolute psychopath monster. So one day, while he was raping Michelle, the little pup wouldn't stop barking. So he stopped what he was doing and he snapped its neck.
Oh my God, I hate this so much. And I feel like for Michelle, who desperately loved that fur baby, it was almost like losing Joey all over again. Like, I'm not saying the puppy didn't take his place, but it gave her something to love and be loved by, something that needed her and depended on her. And then the shitbag just took it all away. And actually, from reports I've read, that wasn't the first animal that he had.
No, and that's not surprising. And this guy already has like his little special place in hell. But when you harm a defenseless animal, mm-hmm. that that special corner in hell has like a janitor's closet. Like that's where he is. Like that is a whole different level, man.
Yeah.
So, but this was all part of his MO. Like he used power and control to manipulate his captives into falling in line. And what better way than to take away something you love? And no joke, this was, we just said it earlier, psychological warfare. So in winter of that year, Castro wouldn't turn the heat on. He refused to give Michelle clothing. So she was naked in this room where she had mentioned in her book that it was so cold that her lips would turn blue. She could see her breath in front of her and she would just beg him for something, like anything to cover up with. But he didn't care. He just ignored her. So when we left you in part one, it was April of 2004 and Castro had just abducted his third victim, who was 14-year-old Gina De Jesus. And as a reminder, he'd already abducted 17-year-old Amanda Berry as well, like almost like clockwork the year before that. And remember, he had kept Amanda confined in a completely separate part of the house than Michelle, where Michelle was. And on the night that he had abducted and brought Gina back to the house on Seymour Avenue, Michelle could hear Gina's terrified screams. She knew it was Gina because she had seen news reports about this girl going missing. And she's like, oh, it makes total sense. And it would be about a full month before Michelle saw or heard Gina again.
I feel like he took her to the torture den in the basement.
That's what we think. And eventually he had brought Gina upstairs and chained her up alongside Michelle in this like weird, disgusting pink room. So there was a bed, if that's what you want to call it, and chains. They were mounted on this black plate kind of on the baseboard. So where the floor meets the wall. But the house was literally equipped for control and torture, every single room. Gina was obviously only 14, but she looked so young and just so scared. And Michelle instantly felt protective over her. And I think I mentioned last week that this is her tumultuous upbringing. So remember, she lived in a car for a while. She was forced to like get her siblings and her cousins off to school, make sure they're clean and showered and teeth brushed. And I think that kind of took over when Gina entered the home. She was younger. She needed someone to care for her. And Michelle was by nature this protector. So because of this shared trauma that we talk about all the time, when people go through these awful experiences together, it like bonds you in the worst way possible. But they obviously establish this kind of close-knit friendship because of their situation. So Castro actually would tie Gina and Michelle together with these chains. And he would often rape one of them while the other was kind of forced to lie there, just helplessly watching or listening. And there were times when he would be raping Gina and Michelle would beg him to take her instead, like take like the sacrificial lamb. But his only response was to beat them both even harder. There was no right answer in this situation. Everything they did, it was damned if you do, damned if you don't.
There's a line in Michelle's book where she says something, I'm not going to quote it, but it's something along the lines of, the only thing worse than being raped yourself is watching someone else be raped.
I can't even imagine. So Castro didn't just abuse these women. He forced them all to participate in this little version of like playing house that he concocted in his sick head. It was weird because he wouldn't really give them the resources to do this. And I was reading something to the effect of he would only give them like a drop of dish soap to do an entire sink full of dishes. And then he would do stupid things like expect things to be a certain way. Like there was a pan that would sit on the stove and they had to take this pan and make sure that it was on the right burner. The handle was facing the right direction because if it was slightly off, they would get beaten. And at one point, Michelle was kind of crying and begging to be let go. And Castro just said, quote, don't cry. You're not supposed to be sad. I want you to be happy here with me. We're supposed to be a family. End quote. What?
What is he talking about? Like, what is going on in that head of his?
I would love to talk to maybe Catherine or Dr. Buzz or somebody about this, because how do you get to this point? Like, does he really believe this, or is this just something he's telling them or telling himself to make this thing seem okay?
I think that if you tell yourself something long enough, you do genuinely start to believe it. And I think that's how, I don't know if it's psychopaths or sociopaths, but.
Yeah, I'd like to find out. I think we should bring in the heavy hitter, bring in an expert to find out. Well, as he was keeping Michelle and Gina chained together in this weird pink upstairs bedroom, he was keeping Amanda in a completely different part of the house. And he continued to keep Michelle and Gina away from Amanda. And Castro had given notebooks and pencils that we were talking about earlier to the girls so that Michelle and Gina would spend hours drawing and writing, and they would pass the time by watching TV. But what a life. Like, can you imagine doing that for 11 years? So one day they hear some voices downstairs. And shortly after, Castro came into their room. This is Michelle and Gina, and announced that he was going to introduce him to his grandson, who was the son of his one of his daughters, Angie. And Michelle and Gina were obviously confused as Castro told them to hide their chains, and like he threatened to kill them both if they let on that anything was wrong. But he's now introducing them to people. I don't know if the family was on to him a little bit and he felt like, I can't keep this house closed off from my relatives or they're going to think something's up. But at the same time, how do I explain what's going on in here? So a couple moments later, this little boy shows up and Michelle guessed he was around maybe 3 or 4 years old and he was going to meet the girls. And Michelle and Gina both said hello to him. And this poor little boy took one look at them and burst into tears, screaming, "Mommy, come get me." And Castro panicked and put his hand over the little boy's mouth and like turned and rushed him downstairs to get him out of that room. And Michelle and Gina were in a state of shock and confusion because they had hoped this might have been the moment that like this could be their ticket out of there. They believed that this boy would say something or speak up, even though he was very young. Maybe he would talk to somebody like an adult and say, "This is what I saw," and it would alert somebody that something was going on in there. But days went by and no rescue came.
And I think it's really important to remember these women, well, this woman and this teenager, they weren't allowed to shower frequently, if at all. They were sharing a bucket as their toilet, which was right next to them. And as Michelle says, it was rarely emptied. They're sharing that dirty mattress. I have to imagine that between the smells and just the horror of the room that they were kept in, I feel like even a 3 or 4 year old would understand that, like, something is not right here.
I agree. And it's interesting. I wasn't going to bring that up, but you did. So we can talk about it. But it's really disturbing to think about, because in the back of my mind, I'm like, if you were sexually abusing these women daily, wouldn't you want them to be clean? Like, it's like he got off on the filth and the kind of disgusting nature of it all, which just adds a whole nother level to this.
Yeah, he was a foul creature. In the book, Michelle talked about how he only bathed once a week. And apparently he just always stunk. His body stunk. His breath stunk. Just
I don't understand
disgusting.
It. Well, regarding this little boy, this grandson. So we don't know if he did say anything, but a few weeks after his visit, Castro came upstairs and announced to Michelle and Gina that they were going back to the basement. So he proceeded to take all three captives, Michelle, Gina, and Amanda, back down to this disgusting, terrifying, it was bigger than a crawl space, but it was musty, it was dingy, it was dirty. It was everything you think it is. And he chains them all to these poles with the chains wrapped around their bodies. As he usually does, he puts a dirty sock in their mouth, duct tape around the head so they can't talk. Ugh. And this was the first time that all three women were together being bound and gagged, and just kind of made communicating with each other impossible. I'm sure you could exchange glances, but I think that all the glances say the same thing. Like, you look at each other and like, we're screwed. They hear voices upstairs at one point and they assume this was Castro's family. So you can see the walls are starting to close in. Like, people are starting to show up at the house. Like, why is there all this commotion when before it was just this isolated chamber of horrors? And they must have been suspicious of something, because one of the voices asked Castro, "What's down there? Can you open this?" And we're pretty sure that this relative or friend was referring to the basement, because after a long pause, Castro responded that it was too messy. There was water down there. And the basement door was just one of many doors in the house that were padlocked. And the unknown voice must not have pushed it any further, because shortly after, Michelle could hear people leaving. And just like with the grandson's visit, she hoped that this meant somebody was going to call the police, but it never came. And later, Castro's family would talk about how he was always very secretive, and he only allowed people in certain parts of the house, and that included the kitchen, if they did visit. And what he would tell them is that he would only heat the kitchen to save money. So there was really no need to go into any of the parts of the house. Don't worry about it. So there was one other time when Castro's family must have come to the house asking questions, because early one morning he had dragged all three of his captives out to this beat up van that he had parked in the backyard, and he kept them in the van for 5 long days. And this was in the middle of the summer. And Michelle writes about how it was so hot and there was zero airflow in this van that she would pass out for hours on end and just wake up back in the same situation she was in.
Oh my God, that would be awful. And he, Castro is so frustratingly ballsy sometimes, like to take all three of them outside and lock them in a van. And I know he threatened them to stay quiet, but so wild that no one saw anything. And there were many times that he would take, especially Michelle, out to the backyard or just sit on the back porch, but he would make her wear a
Yes.
wig and sunglasses, is so strange. And then he started taking her outside to perform hard labor, as he called it. I don't know how nobody saw that. He made her dig a hole the size of a grave. She was just so terrified she was digging her own grave.
This guy was the king of mind games. Sometime in 2004, he began telling Michelle and Gina that Amanda was his wife. So for a while, Gina was like the favorite when she first arrived, because I think she was new and fresh. You get a new toy, basically. And but that quickly shifted to Amanda, though.
Oh.
And I should mention that this led to some jealousy in a weird way between the captives, because it's not that they wanted his attention, believe me, but it was because they had nothing. So if he had a favorite, that person would be given a little extra food. They would be given some extra little amenities that the others didn't get. So it was actually in their best interest. The fact that Amanda was the favorite also meant that he became even crueler to Michelle and Gina, and he fed them less and less. He refused to give them their paper and pencils, which kept them alive. It gave them something to do. Because it absolutely devastated Michelle. I mentioned that she would spend hours writing in her journal or writing to Joey, but so to take that away is just the ultimate slap in the face. I mean, what do you have left? Nothing. So in her book, Finding Me, Michelle writes, quote, "He would consistently push me down the stairs, beat me and punch me or cuss me out. And every time he was done making me bleed, he would remind me, 'You're such an ugly bitch. You're the one I can't stand to look at.' And to make it all better, he'd add, 'At least I didn't kill you.'" End quote. How thoughtful, Ariel Castro.
Oh my God. How can someone be this horrible?
We talked about Bundy. We talked about Gacy. This guy, I feel like, is worse, if that's possible.
And I feel like if this was a horror movie, you would be like, no one can be that terrible.
Isn't a literal monster. In 2006, as a result of these horrific attacks, Amanda became pregnant with Castro's child. And we mentioned this last week, but by now, Michelle had been pregnant 5 times during her captivity, all of which ended in forced abortions by Castro. And the difference here is that when Amanda got pregnant, Castro was pleased about it. And I'm not really sure what to make of this, because it's not like they were this big, happy fa- I mean, in his mind, they were, I guess, but what did he think was going to happen?
I don't know. And he had to know that at some point she was going to talk. She was going to have to go to school. I don't know if he thought maybe that meant Amanda would stay with him.
I don't know.
Like maybe he thought that he could trick her into being a happy family.
I guess, but like, how do you treat someone the way he treated these girls and then expect them to want to be with you? It's absurd. Well, on Christmas Eve 2006, Amanda goes into labor. And Castro ordered Michelle Knight to actually assist in having Barry's child. It took place in a small inflatable swimming pool, and he threatened to kill Michelle if that baby didn't survive. And at one point, the baby stopped breathing, but Michelle, thank God, was able to resuscitate her, because not that it can get any worse, but who knows what he would have done.
Think about the trauma from that situation. Like, he impregnated Michelle several times and he physically and violently aborted those pregnancies. And then he makes Michelle help deliver a baby that he keeps.
It's
What the
beyond screwed
fuck?
up. It's basically like having to help prolong this awful situation only to endure more of it, you know? So it's literally a no-win. And it's super weird here that Castro was very kind to this baby, who Amanda named Jocelyn Jade. And he would even take this baby out of the house. So Castro moved Amanda and Jocelyn into a room where Michelle and Gina were staying. And then he moved them into a connecting room, but it was much smaller. He also allowed Amanda to kind of be free in her room. The door was locked, but she didn't have to have her chains on because he didn't want the baby to see her in chains. And Jocelyn was this bright light to all three of the women who lived there. And Michelle and Gina fell in love with her and would hold her any chance they got.
I think the baby helped all of their morale, though, because it gave them something to care for. It gave them a reason to get up in the morning. Like, I can't lay here. I have to get up because Jocelyn needs A, B, and C.
That's the only explanation. So when the baby was about a year and a half old, Jocelyn did begin to talk. And Castro insisted that Michelle and Gina go by different names because he explained that he didn't want Jocelyn knowing their real names, which I assume would be to confuse police or be like, I don't know who this Michelle and Amanda, you know what I mean? So by the time she was two, Castro also allowed Michelle and Gina to kind of go around the house without chains because he was very concerned that it wasn't good for Jocelyn to see the girls tied up. He gave them kind of a bit more freedom, but he always made sure he had his gun nearby and he made sure that they knew he had his gun nearby.
He would carry his gun around like on him at all times just to be like the silent threat.
Mm-hmm.
And even with that little bit of freedom he allowed, he still played more of his mind games and he would leave a bedroom door unlocked just to see if anyone tried to escape. But this is really awful. Michelle wrote a line in her book and she said, quote, by 2008, we were trained. After years of being in prison, a crazy thing starts to happen. The locks move from off of your wrists and your ankles and up to your brain, end quote, which is really powerful and just drives home the control that he had over these women.
Yeah. At what point does your mind start to give up? Like my mind would give out in no time because there is no light at the end of the tunnel. And especially in Michelle's case, she was there the longest, but I mean, all of these girls were there years and years and years. When you don't know when the end is in sight, how do you go on? Like, you're like, is this just my life now? Like if I got to the point where I thought this is all that my life is ever going to be, I would have swallowed a bunch of pills. I would have found some Drano under the sink. I would have done something.
I agree.
He began taking Jocelyn to church on Sundays and he would bring her downstairs to meet his bandmates. Because remember, he was in this band that would meet like every Saturday night. And he would tell people that Jocelyn was his girlfriend's daughter. Again, he's keeping everything very vague and ambiguous. So his friends I don't know how his friends didn't see it, but they must not have caught on. And one night when Jocelyn was 5 years old, Castro actually took her out to a carnival. When they returned, they had a few hot dogs that they'd gotten at the fair. And Castro told these girls that Jocelyn had wanted to bring them dinner. And these hot dogs had been covered in mustard, which Michelle was deathly allergic to. And Castro knew it. He told Michelle that if she didn't eat the hot dog, he would shoot her. So Michelle ate this hot dog. And within minutes, her face had turned red. Her throat and tongue were swollen. She was struggling to breathe. Her throat was closing up. And when Castro saw her, he shrugged and said, "You'll get over it. Don't worry about it."
Thank God.
So Michelle suffered in horrible pain and was barely conscious for days to the point where she told Gina, "That's it. I'm done. I'm giving up." And Gina stayed by her side the entire time. She fed Michelle, made sure she drank fluids, and she encouraged Michelle to keep fighting because she had to stay alive for baby Joey. That was her. She was for as good a care as Michelle took of Gina when Gina came into the house. I think Gina was trying to repay the favor and remind her, hey, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. You just have to remember what you're fighting for. So by Christmas of 2012, Castro was even more violent toward Michelle, causing yet another, and this is, we mentioned five miscarriages. So this was the fifth and final miscarriage.
Yeah, and Michelle goes into very vivid detail discussing this, and it is incredibly jarring and beyond comprehension, honestly. Like, he was a sick, sick man. And it seems like after this, Michelle understandably all but gave up. And if you think about that, it's almost 2013. She was abducted in 2002. 11 years. Joey's a teenager. Yeah. Like, Joey's a teenager at
this point. She wouldn't even recognize him. She could pass him on the street and not even know that's Joey. Well, we're almost there. So, and honestly, by now you guys get the point. Like, we could go into so much more detail about what happened during that decade, but why? You know, I think we've made our point. Like, I'd rather get to the good part where this monster's reign of terror comes to an end. So May 6, 2013, it was a typical Monday, started out like any other day. Michelle and Gina were in their room listening to music and Amanda was in her room and Jocelyn had just kind of been running around the house. And at one point she says to the girls, "I don't find Daddy. Daddy's nowhere around." And she told Amanda that Daddy went to see Mama. So that was Castro's mom, who he'd actually introduced Jocelyn to at one point.
So weird.
So weird. And Amanda didn't originally take Jocelyn seriously because Castro had played these games before. Hell, he could have told Jocelyn to be like, "Go tell him I'm gone," and see, like, just to see what they do. Mm-hmm. So Amanda knew this was her moment. She told ABC News, quote, my heart immediately started pounding. I'm like, should I chance it? If I do, or if I'm going to do it, I need to do it now. End quote.
Wow.
So Amanda sneaks out of her room and she slowly creeps down the hallway and down the steps. And at this point, she notices that the door's unlocked. And Amanda opens it and realizes the storm door was chained closed, but there was enough room for her to fit her arm out. So there's this little crack.
Wow.
And this badass screams as loud as she can scream.
Yay, Amanda.
Well, and this is a pretty amazing escape slash rescue. So before we get into the guy who actually saves her, the hero per se, I will say that there was another neighbor involved first. And apparently Amanda had gotten this guy's attention, like flagged him down, but he didn't speak English. We couldn't really tell what she was screaming about. He probably assumed it was some kind of domestic violence situation. So he kind of just turned and walked away. And there are conflicting reports about whether or not he actually helped get the attention of the other neighbor that comes in here in a second. But there was another neighbor, Charles Ramsey. And he happened to be sitting on his front stoop eating his McDonald's breakfast when I was like, you know what? It's early in the morning. I'm going to get me a McMuffin and sit on my porch. That's a man after my own heart. He hears Amanda screaming, and he and another neighbor, and this is the neighbor I was talking about, Angel or Angel Cordero, they go running to 2207 Seymour Ave. And this is when Amanda says the words that send shockwaves, not only across Cleveland, but the United States and probably the world. She says, "Help me. Mm-hmm. I'm Amanda Berry. I've been kidnapped and I've been missing for 10 years.
Oof, I got goosebumps.
Right. So the men, or just Charles, again, depending on which report you read, began kicking through the screen door until they broke it enough to get Amanda and Jocelyn out. Jocelyn crawls through this little hole, like picture the panes on a door. And so one of them was busted out just enough to kind of stick Jocelyn through. So they rushed to the neighbor across the street and they used the phone, and Amanda made this infamous 911 call. And Melissa, just like you kind of did with me in the Ian Huntley case, I want you to listen to this clip and tell me what you make of it.
Okay.
Cleveland 911. You need.
Hello, please. Help me. I'm Amanda Berry.
You need police, fire, or ambulance?
I need police.
Okay, and what's going on there?
I've been kidnapped and I've been missing for 10 years and I'm here. I'm free now.
Okay, and what's your address?
2207 Seymour Avenue.
2207 Seymour. Looks like you're calling me from 2210. Oh, yes. Okay, stay there with those neighbors. Talk to the police when they get there.
Okay. Hello?
Yeah, talk to the police when they get there.
Okay, okay. I'm going right now.
We're
going to
send them as soon as we get a car open.
No, I need them now before we get them back.
All right, we're sending them, okay?
Okay, I mean, like,
who's the
right
guy?
Now?
Who's the guy you're, who's the guy who went out?
His name is Ariel Castro. And I'm Amanda Berry. I've been on the news for the last 10 years.
Okay, I got that here. Right, the police are on the way. Talk to them when they get there, okay?
I
told you they're on the way. Talk to them when they get there, okay?
All right, okay.
I feel like the 911 operator could have been a little bit more apathetic, one of the pathetics, I don't know, but Amanda's like, I have been missing for 10 years, get someone here. And she's like, yeah, okay, I'm working on it.
Yeah, the part that jumped out to me was when she kept saying, like, talk to the cops when they get there. Like, every 911 call I've ever heard, they try to get you to stay on the phone, which is so confusing as to why she was just like, she almost didn't care what Amanda had to say. She was like, okay, got your address. Talk to the cops when they get there. It was just very strange. And like you said, apathetic, I guess.
I was wondering that too. I thought they weren't allowed to hang up with the person until the police or first responders got on scene.
Yeah, I don't know, but she took some heat online. Every place that I found this 911 clip, the comments under are like, what a bitch, like fire that 911 operator, like getting on her a lot. And I can see the hate.
I did hear somewhere that they had prank calls like that before. Maybe not saying I'm Mary, but they had prank calls about kidnapping or whatever. So, I mean, maybe she was a little apprehensive to believe it. I don't know.
This story is so unbelievable that, I mean,
yeah.
I would understand if it's like, yeah, okay. So regardless, the police do get there. And as soon as they arrive, Amanda tells them there are two more girls in the house. And this whole time, Michelle and Gina have no idea what's going on. So they hear footsteps and pounding up the stairs and they're terrified. So they turn off the lights and they hide behind a dresser. And remember, all the windows are boarded up. It's dark. And then they hear police. And Michelle peeks out from behind this dresser, and there's a female police officer standing right in front of her. Can you imagine that feeling?
Apparently, Michelle literally threw herself into this female officer's arms and, like, would not let her go.
I would have put myself in her pocket and been like, I'm not leaving your pocket. So all three women and Jocelyn were taken to the hospital, and Amanda, Gina, and Jocelyn were released pretty quickly into the arms of their incredibly thankful and welcoming families. They were obviously sorely missed. Unfortunately, the same couldn't be said for Michelle. She was in pretty bad shape, and she wouldn't have survived a whole lot longer if she was in that house. So this rescue could not have happened at a better time. It may have saved her life.
Yeah.
And in addition to suffering some permanent nerve damage in her arms, her jaw had been seriously damaged due to all the punches and beatings that Castro had inflicted throughout the years, including when he punched her in the face with a dumbbell. Remember, that's what he used to cause one of the miscarriages too, hit her right in the stomach with a dumbbell. She also had a really bad bacterial infection that was basically eating away at her stomach. She would actually need facial reconstruction as well to kind of make herself look semi-normal again, like herself. So when Michelle was released from the hospital, she lived in an assisted living home for a while until she got kind of acclimated with the world that she'd been out of for the past 11 years. And while she did see one of her brothers, I don't know if it was Freddie or Eddie, while she was in the hospital, she kind of made the decision not to see any other family members. And I don't blame her one bit.
It was Freddie that she saw, but I'm sure that that was not an easy decision to make. But I think it was the right decision. And there's a part in the book where she talks about how, you know, the whole nation had heard her story, and she had been sent so many flowers and balloons and well wishes from, like, everyone. And she writes, quote, "After feeling invisible for most of my life, I felt overwhelmed to suddenly have so much attention. But I was very grateful. People who didn't even know me were showing me more love than I had ever felt in my entire life," end quote.
I'm happy that she felt love.
Yeah.
That she, like, knew that feeling, because even though it was under the worst circumstances,
seriously,
at least she got to feel what that feels like. But I was thinking about this. At this part in the story, I was like, this is a completely superficial note, but can you imagine coming into a brand new world and, like, all the things that have changed, especially, like, it was such a technological revolution between 2002 and 2013. I mean, I'm sure she did have that TV, so she was kind of up on current events and what was going on, but I would imagine that adjusting was not easy. Like, I imagine it's like spending 11 years in prison or being in a coma. Like, you wake up like, where am I? What space age am I in?
Yeah, she said that she was actually given an iPhone and she had no idea what to even do with it, what it was. Like, it was totally foreign to her. And she also mentioned little things like how on the drive from the hospital to the assisted living, there were buildings and shops where, you know, it had been fields before. And she even pointed out that the Cleveland City buses had changed their look.
Oh, wow. Well, and for what it's worth, as a lifetime Android user, when I'm handed an iPhone, I don't know what to do with it either. So,
oh my God. No, he doesn't.
I tried to do something on Brenda's phone. I'm like, how do you go back? I just want to go back. And I could not. I think I restarted the phone. I don't know what. Well, on July 26, 2013, Ariel Castro pleads guilty to more charges than I've ever heard in my entire life. 937, to be exact. And these charges included multiple counts of rape, assault, murder for forcibly ending all of Michelle's pregnancies. And his sentencing hearing was held on August 1st, 2013. We talked about this whole block being about badass women and girl power. After everything that Michelle endured, she shows up at this sentencing hearing, not just in attendance, but stands up and reads a statement and basically looks this guy in the eye. And how empowering.
I think that that was also so important for her to take a weight off of herself.
Yeah, I'm in control, not you.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Amanda and Gina did not attend the sentencing, but they did send in statements to be read, which happens sometimes. And when Castro was given his turn to speak and respond, he again claimed that he was abused as a child, that he had a porn addiction, which we brought up last week, that none of this was his fault. I'm not a monster. He was air quotes sick. Yeah, you think? This guy had the audacity to tell the court that all the sex he had with the girls was consensual.
I want to know how Michelle was able to control herself to not fly across the courtroom and strangle him.
I'm not sure.
I feel like the guards would let me take a minute to get over there, but...
Yeah. Well, the judge handed down one of the harshest sentences I've ever heard. Life without parole. So this guy got LWOP and 1,000 years on top of it. Like 1,000 years. And it was also agreed upon that the House of Horrors at 2207 Seymour Ave would be destroyed. That was part of this plea deal. So in August of 2013, we're talking almost 3 months to the day. I think it was like August 6th or 7th. After the girls were rescued, the city of Cleveland fired up the bulldozers. And at 7:20 a.m., Michelle Knight was there to hand out yellow balloons for everyone to release. And Gina DeJesus' aunt, Peggy Arida, she literally manned the excavator and had the pleasure of taking the first swipe at the house. And by lunchtime, the house was reduced to a pile of rubble.
Wow.
Cuyahoga County Prosecutor Tim McGinty said, quote, "This house represented evil incarnate, which is Ariel Castro. Mm-hmm. Now it's gone."
Wow.
And interestingly, while I was researching this case, do you know how Google Maps is only updated every few years?
Mm-hmm.
Well, while I was kind of looking up some stuff and looking for pictures, I learned that a couple of the pictures that I Googled, the house was blurry. And I'm like, why on earth is this? So I dug into it a little bit. And apparently in 2013, after this happened, Google Maps made the decision to blur that address because when the picture was taken, the girls were actually still entrapped there. So it makes sense. I think it was just a privacy thing that, or they felt like this isn't right. Like now that we know they were in there, we don't want people looking at this house.
That's wild. And I think the house definitely needed to be destroyed. Like, I can't imagine walking past it. I feel like that needed to happen for the community to heal almost. But I do love that sentence, though, especially the plus 1,000 years. I mean, it's still not enough of a punishment.
Well, neither is this. So on September 3rd, this was about a month after Castro was sentenced, Castro was found dead in his cell of an apparent suicide. He had hung himself with a bedsheet, and there are conflicting reports to this, but we do know that he was found with his pants around his ankles, fully exposed to the world. And this led to some theories that he died while engaging in some kind of autoerotic asphyxiation, but I'll kind of give you what we do know and you can decide for yourself. So there were things found in Castro's cell. There were a few notes and drawings dated September 3rd, so it was the same day. And the notes have some Bible scriptures along with the words, "Those who confess with their heart will be saved." In all capital letters there on one of the papers, it said, "God loves you." And then Castro wrote, for all our sinners, we all fall short of the glory of God. Christ is my Savior and yours." And his drawings depict a heart that's inscribed with the words love. And then inside the heart were my kids and grandkids. So I will also mention that some inmates were questioned after this event, and they had told authorities that Castro would often go without underwear. Like sometimes he just didn't wear it. And he often struggled to keep his pants up because he had lost so much weight in prison. So was this suicide? I certainly think so, but those are the facts. You be the judge.
They actually, when they were going through the house, they found another suicide note, which obviously he never carried out, but they found about $22,000, and he told them to give that money to Amanda, Michelle, and Gina.
So strange.
Why would he do,
It's like he knew what he was doing was wrong and that he was going to get caught at some point, but until he does, let's keep it going. I don't know.
They said no to the money. Absolutely not.
Well, this guy couldn't even handle a single month in conditions that were 1,000 times better than what he'd subjected Michelle, Amanda, and Gina to.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to switch gears for a minute and talk about Joey, because in case Michelle's journey hasn't been traumatic enough, it's not even over yet. So as soon as Michelle escaped, her main concern was obviously Joey. And her lawyer had to eventually give her the news that Joey had been adopted. Because when Michelle disappeared, it was assumed that she just took off. So Joey was adopted by a loving family. So needless to say, Michelle was crushed. But through the lawyers, Michelle was able to send a letter to Joey's adoptive parents, who didn't really want Michelle to have any interaction with Joey whatsoever. So there's no telling if he ever got that letter.
That's so sad because it's the only thing that got her through those 11 years of hell was Joey. And I don't understand how that can happen if she didn't sign her rights away. Like, that is so sick. She's being punished again for what Castro, you know? Like,
yeah, I don't know if it's
like
a thing.
I feel like that's such a big injustice.
When you're presumed dead, maybe? Or just presumed that 11 years had passed, that you're not coming back, if there's some kind of law where they can... That maybe her parents had something to do with it. I don't know. Or her mom.
Well, I'm pretty sure that it was shortly after. Like, they adopted him when he was still very young. So I don't think she had been gone for very long. But the letter she wrote to the adoptive parents was beautiful. And she said she understood why they were not letting her see Joey. And I just want to read a little part from her letter where she writes, quote, "I know you will always be his parents, and that won't change. I won't try to take him away. I am just hoping you can help me fill the hole in my heart with whatever photos or stories you are willing to share with me." End quote.
Wow.
I'm like, holy shit, I'm not a parent. Imagine the pain of not being Joey's, like, mom anymore is more painful than anything Castro could have inflicted. Shit. Like, if for nothing else, Michelle is truly an extraordinary woman for putting her feelings aside for the sake of Joey to, you know, kind of have a normal life. Because this would have been, I'm sure, like, the media would have been beating down his adoptive parents' doors and, you know.
Totally. And just imagine that one driving force that is getting you through this nightmare and you can't have it. It's like playing a game where the odds are completely stacked against you, but then there's no prize at the end of the game. You win and there's no prize. The family did send her photos of Joey, but as far as we know, they have not been in contact. And we're not even sure if his name is still Joey, to be completely honest. And I don't know if his adoptive parents have ever told him anything about Michelle or what she went through. And it's a shame because how heroic, you know? I get that it's an awful situation, but I feel like he's going to have some questions later in life.
Yeah, I mean, who knows if he even knows he's adopted, you know? Like, he was young enough that he probably wouldn't remember anything.
Yeah, it's true.
But she is so strong for being able to accept that they're his parents now. I think that's incredible.
I agree. Well, and there is a little silver lining in this awful case. And I'll tell you that everybody seems to be doing very well as of 2025. So Gina DeJesus, she co-founded the Cleveland Family Center for Missing Children and Adults in 2018 with her cousin Sylvia Colon, to help families navigate the challenges of missing persons cases. And she has spoken about the importance of being aware of one's surroundings and not being afraid to get involved and say something. Amanda Berry, she's actively involved in initiatives aimed at finding missing children. And she partnered with the U.S. Marshals Service for Operation Safety Net, which it resulted in the safe recovery of 35 missing children in Ohio over a one-month time period. And she has discussed her journey of healing and rebuilding her life on she's done many interviews, expressing gratitude for her support system and the ability to find just happiness and love. Some, like you said earlier, a normal life. Like, how do you even go back to normal? But somehow all three of these girls have managed to do it. And finally, Michelle Knight, she has changed her name to Lily Rose Lee. And she's very open about her journey into healing, which involved a lot of equine therapy. So she was big into horses because she had an incredible love of animals this whole time. And that's what makes that puppy story even sadder, because this girl really loved animals. And she ended up opening an animal shelter not that long ago, actually, and ran into some issues with the county. But I don't want to speculate or kind of get into too many details because I don't know what actually happened there. All I know is that Michelle loves animals dearly. Lily Rose Lee loves animals dearly. And she just wants the absolute best for them.
Yeah, the three of them have done incredible. And apparently Jocelyn is doing really well. And I was just reading an article about how when she turned 16, that's how old Amanda was when she was abducted.
I want to end this incredible story with one of my favorite viral clips in the history of the internet. This has been all over TikTok. It's been Facebook Reels, Insta Reels. It's the clip that everyone sees. It comes at the end of the short video I want to show you guys, but I'll play the whole thing. It's only like 90 seconds long, and it is a classic, and it honestly had the power to end racism right then and there. And this is an interview with Charles Ramsey. He did a quick interview. There's people everywhere. Like, this is in the commotion of everything that just happened. And he's speaking with a news reporter, immediately following the police breaking in and saving these girls.
Hey, Charles, let me talk to you. I'm talking with Charles Ramsey. He's a neighbor. Walk me through again what happened this afternoon. You heard screaming.
Heard screaming. I meet my McDonald's. I come outside. I see this girl going nuts trying to get out of her house. So I go on the porch. Okay. I go on the porch, and she says, help me get out. I've been in here a long time. So, you know, I figured it's a domestic violence dispute. So I open the door, and we can't get in that way because how the door is, it's so much that a body can't fit through, only your hand. So we kick the bottom, and she comes out with the little girl, and she says, call 911. My name was Amanda Berry.
Now, did you know who that was when she said that?
When she told me, it didn't register until I got the call of 911. And then I'm like, I'm calling the 911 for Amanda Berry? I thought this girl was dead. You know what I mean? And she got on the phone and she said, yes, this is me. And the detective, Cook, right here, Detective Gregory Cook says, Charles, do you know who you rescued? I said.
Now, and when did you see Gina?
About five.
We're good.
So about 5 minutes after the police got here, see, the girl Amanda told the police, I ain't just the only ones. It's some more girls up in that house. So they went up there, you know, 30, 40 deep, and when they came out, was just astonishing because I thought they were going to come up with nothing. I figured, whoever she was, and like I say, my neighbor, you got some big testicles to pull this off, bro, because we see this dude every day. I mean, every day.
How long have you lived here?
I've been here a year.
Okay.
You see where I'm coming from? Right. I barbecue with this dude. We eat ribs and whatnot and listen to salsa music. You see where I'm coming from?
Yeah. And you had no indication that there was anything going on?
Bro, not a clue that girl was in that house or anybody else was in there against their will. Because how he is, he just comes out to his backyard, plays with the dogs, tinker with his cars and motorcycles, goes back in the house. So he's somebody that you look away because he's not doing nothing but the average stuff. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. And nothing exciting about him. Well, until the day.
what was the reaction on the girls' faces? I can't imagine to see the sunlight, to be around people.
I knew something was wrong when a little pretty white girl ran into a black man's arms. Something is wrong here. Dead giveaway.
Charles, thank you very much.
Dead giveaway.
Thank you very much for your time. And
either she homeless or she got problems. That's the only reason why she run to a black man.
Charles, thank you for being there, man. Charles Ramsey, neighbor, heard the screaming, took action, went and did what he needed to do. The rest is unfolding before us here on CMAR. I'm going to send it back to you.
Charles, you, sir, are a national treasure.
How great is that? Like, it makes me laugh every time because just knowing the story and knowing we're going to be covering it. But that clip, oh my God, it's so fun. It's so perfect. It's so perfect. Well, the best part of this whole thing is that there were rewards offered. Obviously, we saw the missing posters over the years. So there were rewards offered for information on these girls. And Charles turned down the reward. And I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but basically he said, give it to the girls. So this guy is the man. He is. I hate to make him the MVP of the week, the MU MVP of the week when we're doing girl power stories about these survivors. But man, Charles is my dude. I like him.
Yeah, he's pretty awesome.
Well, that is it for the miracle in Cleveland. And man, that a miracle is the perfect word for this case, because that's the only way these girls could have survived what Ariel Castro did to them.
They are incredible. I don't know how reading Michelle's book was wild, and I don't know how any of them did it. But Ed, do you want to tell everyone what they can expect next week?
You know, I always get to do the honors. Why don't you go ahead? I'll leave you make the announcement.
Man, this is big. Well, next week we are going to have Lily Rose Lee, aka Michelle Knight.
How super cool. And not to rip the rug out from this plan, but I will say we've had to reschedule a couple times. So, or I should say, if everything goes as planned this week, we will be conducting her interview and bringing it to you guys next week. But if not, we promise to deliver an equally awesome badass woman. They just won't be associated with the story. And they are also TBD onto who that badass is. We got to find one. I don't want to set you up for a letdown. We just want to prepare you all for the worst. But if you want girl power, my God, this is the epitome.
It truly is. We are super excited to talk with her. And after hearing everything she went through, it's just, it's amazing to see her now when she's happy and smiling after everything we know happened.
She is. And she's super cool. Like, she's just so down to earth about everything and just the sweetest girl. Like, I love talking to her. She's so friendly and you guys are going to love her.
Well, stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, check out our socials, Facebook, Insta, TikTok at Murder Unscripted. You can email us at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com, or you can hit us up through our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com.
That's it.
So until then, we want everyone to stay safe, be kind, and remember, if this story taught you nothing else, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
Seriously, like, if this story didn't show you that, we don't have one that will. Like, this is this is the pervert. This is the guy.
This is it.
See ya.